Hey everyone. Last week, the San Diego Union-Tribune partnered with the National Conflict Resolution Center to hold a discussion on race and equity. It's part of the NCRC's APATH Forward series, and it featured three voices that have been driving the conversation following the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protests. They include Ibram X. Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and Wesley Lowery, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who came to prominence following his coverage of Ferguson for the Washington Post. Enjoy the show.
Massive increase in unemployment
is filled with people who are critically ill from COVID-19.
This is just an unprecedented situation in the United States. I mean, you've got three crises going on at the same time.
Vowing to send U.S. troops into the streets of American cities if local authorities don't control the protest.
Are you going to allow the government to tell you you have to wear a mask?
Increasingly, we Americans occupy alternate universes. There is very little common ground left, only battling perceptions of reality.
Escalated into fistfights.
Political arguments seem to be taking over social media.
You're on social media where simple conversations can go south.
Like the growing like hatred towards anybody that's conservative, being labeled a Nazi or a white nationalist isn't true.
On the streets of Charlottesville today, the hate boiling over white supremacists.
One person is dead after a synagogue shooting.
In the wake of the synagogue shooting in Poway, leaders from the National Conflict Resolution Center have launched a new program to bring people together that wouldn't normally spend time with one another.
Today, the National Conflict Resolution Center will host a workshop to find ways to prevent violence and hate in our communities.
Human beings by nature are afraid of other people who are different from them. And what NCRC does is demystify other.
Here we have actually seen families that can't even talk about race relations or politics at a family dinner anymore.
Times like these that we all must learn to live, give, and love again.
Diversity and inclusiveness make us better in every aspect of our lives.
The social justice issues, police brutality, and I felt particularly that our students and our college communities were well prepared for this, largely because we had invested over the years in many training programs. We had only to reach into the toolbox.
The mission of NCRC is to get those tools in the hands of as many people as it can, to disrupt the pipeline to prison, to support restorative justice in our schools instead of expulsion and instead of the juvenile justice system.
So this is just one example of an incredible program that NCRC has worked with us on that represents what the future of criminal justice should look like.
We are on the precipice of making important systemic changes in American society.
They want to create civility and civil discussion, not yelling and screaming and venting and pointing fingers, but on finding solutions
together. We can do more as a community to bridge the divides and close the systemic, economic, and justice gaps that still exist today. Bank of America recently announced a four-year, $1 billion commitment to help local communities advance economic opportunity and address racial inequality.
You just have to have empathy for the people you're working with and understand where they're coming from, and maybe I can help them. Maybe they can help me. So it's a new way of looking at the future.
I'm Wesley Lowery of CBS News, and I'm proud to support the National Conflict Resolution Center's fight against racism.
NCRC believes that there is always a better way, and that way, it's a path forward.
I'm Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, and I am thrilled to be able to support the National Conflict Resolution Center's commitment to anti-racism.
We're in a challenging time in the championship rounds of life, and those are the toughest rounds. We're much better than this. We can win.
And I believe NCRC is one of those tools that we need.
Hello, I'm Ibram X. Kendi. I'm the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, and I'm excited to support the National Conflict Resolution Center's efforts for equity and justice for all.
It's never been a more important time for conflict resolution at home, in our communities, and throughout the nation.
The country needs the National Conflict Resolution Center today more than ever.
Good evening. I'm Tom Turner, the chairman of the board of the National Conflict Resolution Center. Thank you, Malin, for your generosity, for your leadership, and for your commitment to the great work of the NCRC. Welcome to a thought-provoking conversation among three thought leaders on racism in America, Robin DiAngelo, Ibram Kendi, and Wes Lowry. We have generous support for tonight's program by very forward-thinking corporations like SDG&E, Bank of America, UC San Diego Extension, Rady Children's Hospital, San Diego Union Tribune, the University of San Diego, KPBS, Warwick's, and the Indigent Criminal Defense Fund. We're also so grateful for our very generous host committee. It was a great honor to present to Congressman John Lewis our NCRC National Peacemaker Award in 2014. We heard directly from the conscience of America that powerful message of nonviolence and equality. I'm going to miss that giant on shoulders we stand. In light of recent events, it's obvious that our efforts to build peace through dignity, respect, inclusive communications, and civility are needed now more than ever. That has been the mission of the National Conflict Resolution Center since our founding in 1983. NCRC is committed to addressing the most challenging issues in pursuit of enduring peace. We do it by building community, one person at a time. I'm hopeful that this evening will inspire you to action, to join our community. After 30 years as a trial lawyer, NCRC's Director of Development, Chris Hulbert, felt his warrior energy was fading, but his peacemaker energy was building. That's when he came to NCRC, and we're so fortunate to have him. Here's Chris Hulbert.
Thank you, Tom. The other day, a friend of mine said to me, "I saw you on the news. There was a protest," he said, "a caravan of cars driving through rich neighborhoods, honking their horns against economic injustice. You were there," he said, "and the camera kept focusing on you, like you were the target of the protest." I was there. I saw the demonstration and the cameras. I was visiting an 80-year-old widow. Her late husband had been a medical engineer. His inventions are used by surgeons around the world, saving millions of lives. I was there with a mask on and physically distancing to have lunch with her and tell her about this event. You see, she's a first-generation immigrant, a person of color, English as a second language, a repeated target of racism. At the end of our visit, without my even asking, she offered the largest gift of any individual for this event and the anti-racist programming it supports. None of that is what the news crew had in mind when they flashed the camera on me, a middle-aged white guy in a sport coat standing in front of a big house. I share that story because it highlights how quickly we all interpret images and judge people based on our own prejudice. The truth is, our brains are lazy that way. It seems that we tend to see the world through the lens of a narrative already running, conscious or unconscious. And it's hard for us to slow down, to meet people, to listen, and get to know who people really are. That's what the National Conflict Resolution Center is about, giving people the skills and tools necessary to find common solutions, to transform cultures together. In the art of inclusive communication, we teach how to move beyond unquestioned ideas to allow changed behaviors. the bystander challenge teaches the most effective way to offer and receive feedback on racist and harassing behaviors in a manner most likely to minimize escalation and maximize self-reflection, growth, and change. With facilitated community dialogue, we bring together people who disagree on fundamental issues. We create an opportunity to discuss race and gender, the environment and crime openly, rationally, and respectfully. These same strategies also inform NCRC's restorative justice practices. The most successful anti-racist criminal justice reform in the nation. We know from tens of thousands of interactions in communities, workplaces, schools and college campuses, government agencies, and homes, the results are both predictable and repeatable. With a path forward, we all can move beyond our uncomfortable feelings to shared transformative results. Communities that are healthier, more vibrant, less violent, and more inclusive. Catherine Shade is the program director at NCRC's Center for Community Cohesion, where a path forward is fostering social, cultural, and economic equality in our most diverse communities. Catherine?
Thank you, Chris. I'm excited about our conversation this evening with Ibram X. Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, and Wes Lowry, because we're doing the work they're writing about. A path forward is what we need in the nation to overcome racism, hatred, and intolerance. It's how we can work together to navigate and recover from the new challenges in the pandemic. At NCRC, we bring people together to break down barriers, repair harm, create relationships, and build stronger communities. We empower people and transform cultures in homes, schools, workplaces, and communities. Hannah Venizelos is a program manager in our training institute. She brings high energy and a warm spirit to our interactive workshops where anyone can learn the skills and the strategies to resolve conflict.
And when I'm facilitating workshops, I get to see those moments of clarity when people realize that they can solve conflict on their own. So we train everyone from corporate CEOs all the way to high school students. It's for everyone. It is all inclusive, and we want to learn how we can communicate well, even if we come from different backgrounds and spaces. We are challenging people to step into these spaces that are often so uncomfortable for us. We're afraid of the outcome. We're afraid of retaliation. We want to change the way that people look at conflict and hopefully guide them toward seeing it as an opportunity, opportunity to reach a resolution, see a different perspective, and we can treat each other with respect and dignity.
We bring people together for courageous conversations, people from different cultures, races, politics, and economics. Nobody facilitates these community conversations better than Mikhail Touré.
Community conversations are extremely important now because of all that's going on in this planet. This world is going through a lot of changes and challenges, and people are being harmed, people are hurt, people are confused, people are going through things by themselves with separation of their families and communities. So especially right now, it's important to have these community conversations. We're all human beings on this planet, and we all have needs that need to be addressed. We all have a need of being acknowledged. To be validated who we are. I'm very passionate about this work because I am doing my best to live a restorative life. I came from a broken family, divorce, separation, addiction, and alcoholism. So coming out of that environment, I was in need of restoration. I was in need of support. I was in need of community. I would say the best possible outcome
out of a conversation within the community or in the circle format or whatever format is to walk away better than we came into that space. To come together, we are stronger, we are wiser, and it's necessary. I mean, as necessary as drinking water or breathing air, eating food. So if we're going to survive during these times, we have to come together.
All the realities of family, neighborhood, and relationships come to school with students. J.C. Niblas brings the wisdom of an ancient culture when he works with students so that they too can succeed.
The school is supposed to be a place where they're safe and they're connected to an adult. In order for people to feel comfortable and safe, they need to build relationships amongst themselves. And that's why it's important that we do this in the schools. When something happens in a school and there's a relationship established, it's easier for people to have that authentic dialogue and the situation can be resolved. It allows more than anything for students not to be criminalized or be targeted. It allows for them to have a voice and also gives them an opportunity to just express what concerns they may have or the way they were treated to really show what they're going through. When people come together, whether it be a person harm or a person responsible, and we talk to them and we prep them and we give them an opportunity to just have a face-to-face dialogue, it really opens them up and they can get to the root of what the issue is. A lot of the times it becomes very powerful because you see the human side of the other person, and it's not a person responsible or a person harm, it's just two human beings having a conversation together. It's important for me that I continue to do this work and that young people continue to have a voice, continue to be loved, to have an adult that cares about them in the most genuine way.
Ido Gele is a Somali refugee working with youth who get arrested. She is a strong and resilient woman interrupting the pipeline to prison as a restorative justice facilitator.
So I grew up in this neighborhood. It's a predominantly East African first generation community. My family immigrated here in the early 90s. What we're seeing in our community is brown and black kids are being disproportionately affected by the criminal justice system here. I personally have had instances where family members have been targeted by the police and put in the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system for small infractions. You hear of stories of family members being broken apart by things like this, but you don't know how horrible it is until it happens to you. So I don't want to see children in our community be thrown away for a small mistake and see it alter their future. I want to be able to give them an opportunity to believe that this isn't who they are, this isn't where their story ends. I believe that we can change the criminal justice system doing this work. Through restorative practices, I believe that we can make a change, that we can show people that you're not numbers, you're humans, and there are organizations and people out there that care.
All these interventions flow from the work we've done at NCRC for nearly 40 years. We know there is a solution. We've resolved more than 20,000 disputes, and we've trained over 30,000 people. We've worked across 12 countries and across 4 continents. At our core, we're about people, bringing people together across disputes to resolve conflicts with respect, civility, and dignity.
I'm Hannah Venizelos, and I am the National Conflict Resolution Center.
I am Mikael Askia Toure, and I am the National Conflict Resolution Center.
My name is JC, and I am the National Conflict Resolution Center.
I am Ido Gele, and I am the National Conflict Resolution Center.
Back to Chris for more.
Catherine, you and your team are doing amazing work, work that's needed in every community across the nation. Tonight, with more than 8,000 registered guests, we have an unprecedented opportunity to expand the work and reach more. You, our audience, you can create the change our nation needs now. With me is Mike Hogan to explain how you can do that.
Thanks so much, Chris, and thanks to all of you that have come together tonight for this groundbreaking conversation and a path forward. In just a minute, I will be asking you to contribute to our work, and I'm going to cover many giving levels. They will be coming up on your screen underneath the live stream. Now, if you are viewing in full screen, we'd ask you to do us a favor. Exit that at this time so you can see the levels below the stream. Now, when I reach a dollar level that is comfortable for you, all you need to do is click on that amount and know that we appreciate your support. Once I'm done going through the individual levels, we're going to bring them all back up at the bottom of your screen, and they will remain there throughout the amazing conversation to come. So we're going to be going rather quickly through the higher levels, but at the end, they are all going to come back up. So if you miss it the first time, don't worry, you're going to get a second chance. You may donate at any time. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, by joining this conversation tonight, you've taken an important step forward to create meaningful change in the world that needs repair. You can do even more by supporting the work of the National Conflict Resolution Center. It's work that NCRC has been doing for nearly 40 years, as we just heard, in 12 countries, 4 continents, 6 cabinet-level departments, and all across the nation. And there's a simple idea at its heart, that by learning how to talk to each other, we can solve even the toughest problems, even when we're talking to someone who doesn't look or think like us. We invite you to join NCRC on a path forward to build a more civil, respectful, and peaceful society. I want to give you a quick idea as to how NCRC uses the funds that we are going to raise tonight. $5,000 can accomplish so much good. One of their signature programs is training for a group of 50 people. It helps them become more effective communicators, especially in times of conflict. Or opening up a community dialogue that brings together 50 strangers to discuss challenging topics in a safe space and to find common ground. Or you may want to donate in support of NCRC's restorative justice work, an anti-racist response to a juvenile justice system that most often punishes youth of color. Every $5,000 raised will provide a lifeline to a kid who gets in trouble, keeping them in school and out of jail. And that's our goal. Of course, NCRC is grateful for your donation in any amount. And I'm thrilled to say, to start things off, we have had a very generous anonymous donor at $50,000, and we cannot thank them enough. I know it's a lot of money, but if you've had Apple stock and you've had a good year and you'd like to go ahead and match at that $50,000 level, please go ahead and click the link that's underneath the live stream at $50,000. I'm going to move through these levels rather quickly. You will have a chance to donate later on. The next dollar level is the $25,000 level. That will pay for 5 of the NCRC signature programs, any one of the 3, 5 times. We already have one donor from the Jaffe family at $25,000. We'd like to thank the Jaffe family. The $25,000 button is right below the live stream. If you'd like to join them, simply click on that button and know that we appreciate your support. Our next level, ladies and gentlemen, is the $10,000 level. And again, that will pay for 2 of NCRC's signature programs. To start things off at $10,000, we'd like to say very special thanks to Karen and Jeff Silberman. They have donated at $10,000. And at this time, I invite you to join Karen and Jeff by clicking the $10,000 donor link underneath the live stream. Again, for every $5,000 raised, we can provide our signature training, The Art of Inclusive Communication, up to 50 people. And at $5,000, we had several generous donors already tonight. Dorian and Bill Saylor, Chuck Nichols, Linda and Mel Katz, thank you, thank you. Tina and Bill Logan and Nancy Guyberson have already come together and donated at the $5,000 level. The $5,000 level should be under your screen now, as well as the rest of the dollar amounts. So if you would like to donate at that level, please feel free to go ahead and do so at this time. I want to touch base on the $2,500 level. Again, we've had several generous donors already join NCRC at this level. First of all, a big thanks to Susan McClellan, Kevin Quinn, Ann and Betty Haddad, the Epstein Family Foundation, and anyone else that would like to join them at the $2,500 level. For every 2 $2,500 donations, that is one more signature program we can provide, such as our community dialogue that again brings together 50 strangers to discuss challenging topics in a safe space and to find common ground. The next level is $1,000, and I am so excited to let you know we have a matching grant from the Indigent Criminal Defense Fund for the next 75 gifts of $1,000. Now, we've already had about 15 or 20 come in. Sue Kalish, Judy McDonald, and a few others have already donated at the $1,000. Remind you, your $1,000 donation with the match from the Indigent Criminal Defense Fund becomes a $2,000 donation. Where else do you get the opportunity for a two-for-one? So again, if you would like to donate at the $1,000 level, please do so. If you're more comfortable at the $500 level, that should be on the field as well. Once again, right underneath the live stream, we have all the various donation levels, including $250. If that is your comfort zone, NCRC would appreciate your donation at that amount. And lastly, we've had too many to mention already at the $100 level, but again, each and every dollar helps, and we appreciate your support. So I want to thank you again for your generous support. Remind you, if you didn't get a chance to donate yet, I moved rather quickly because I know we want to get to the conversation, but you may do so at any time during the conversation to come. The donation levels will be available throughout this evening's live stream. They will be right underneath the streaming window as long as you are not in full screen. Again, we appreciate you coming together with us tonight and helping NCRC create a path forward. Enjoy the conversation, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, everyone, for your generosity and your commitment to join with NCRC in our work of rebuilding better. Wes Lowry is a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for his investigation following the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. He's with us to facilitate the conversation with America's two number one best-selling authors on racism, Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo. Welcome, Wes.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Chris. And thank you, everyone who worked hard to make this event possible and everyone who's tuning in today. We're going to have a really great conversation. My name is Wesley Lowry. I'm a reporter and author with CBS News. And I'm excited to have what I think is going to be a really smart conversation today about this moment we are living in, as well as the ideas of racism and anti-racism. And I've got with me two of the leading scholars in this space, folks whose work you've probably interacted with and who you may have questions for. I know I do as well. And so let me briefly introduce Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo. You've seen their books all over the New York Times bestseller list recently, and you've also seen them talking about this idea of anti-racism. Now, one term, and I think I certainly used it already, I'm sure both of you will, that we're seeing discussed a lot right now is this idea of what does it mean to be an anti-racist? What is anti-racism, right? And that is a term that in the broad national conversation is relatively new, even if it's one that has roots and has been being used historically. One might argue that you two are among the scholars helping define that. How do each of you define the term anti-racism or anti-racist activity? What does that mean, and how does that relate to the conversation we're having now?
Sure. So I would say that we have racial inequity and injustice in our society, and to be anti-racist is to look out at this racial inequity and not see what's wrong with Black people, not see what's wrong with Native or Latinx immigrants. To be anti-racist is to recognize the racial groups, despite any differences, as equals. And so when you have thereby racial inequity and injustice, and you believe that the racial groups are equals, the only other explanation is an explanation that racist policies, that racist structures, that racist power is behind these racial inequities. And so there, then to be anti-racist is to then challenge these policies, to challenge this power, to create more equitable policies, to create policies, I should say, enact policies that lead to sort of equal opportunity and justice for all. So to be anti-racist is also to be willing to admit the times in which we are being racist, to you know, for white people, to use Robin's terms, to not be so fragile, and to have the ability to admit when we're being racist. And so while someone who's being racist always denies it and indeed says they're the least racist person anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, racism is the foundation of our society, of our country, of our institutions. By every measure, racial inequality is reproduced. Our schools are particularly effective at reproducing racial inequality. And that means that racism is not an aberration, it's actually the norm, right? And in a society in which racism is the norm, to not actively seek to interrupt it is to collude with it by default. You know, as a white person, I move through a society in which racism is the norm in racial comfort. I mean, just take that in for a moment. I am comfortable in a racist society as a white person. And so racial comfort in a sense is a sign of racism in a society that keeps reproducing these outcomes. And so putting anti makes it active. If you are not actively challenging that status quo, you are participating in the status quo. And it really changes the conversation for me as a white person from if I'm racist, to which most white people will answer no. And if my answer is no, what further action is required of me? Well, none, I'm not racist. But when you understand that it is the default, you change that question to how. How have I been shaped by this system? And how might I be colluding with it? And that puts me on a lifelong trajectory of strategic intentional action.
Now, one of the things that the NCRC focuses on and talks about is the importance of all voices and different types of voices being included in these types of conversations, right? We're in a moment where we are talking about, right, how do we center certain types of experiences in a world where perhaps your white audience is grappling with their own complicity in a system or trying to figure out what their role is in this type of conversation. How do you think folks should sort through that? How do we have conversations that acknowledge the differences and experiences that people have, but that also don't, you know, systemically silence certain types of voices? You know, how should different types of people who are coming to this conversation with different backgrounds and different experiences, how should they think about their role in this big conversation, especially at a time where you do have people out there who are concerned that if they say the wrong thing, they'll get shouted down or canceled or run out of town?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it speaks to this framework of either or, right? You either are racist or you are not. These are fixed categories in a lot of people's minds. And if you're not racist, you're a good person. And if you're racist, you're a bad person. So even the fear, what if I say something racist, therefore I won't say anything at all? I mean, well, that's one way to go about it. I would want to know. And that's a question I would offer. Do you want to know if you are inadvertently reinforcing a racist ideology or assumption? Would you not want to be open to receiving that feedback? That engenders curiosity and humility. And again, just being open to taking a look at this. I don't think we can get there from the current paradigm that is a very simple formula of either or.
Yeah, and I also think that people have to realize that to be raised in the United States and in many other countries is to be raised to think that there's something wrong with darker people, in this case, Black and brown and indigenous people. And so that then becomes the norm. Like, and many people don't even know that they are drenched with racist ideas because they've been taught their whole life that they're dry. And so I think if people realize that, and then I think if people also realize that people taught them to think that way, that people were mass producing these racist ideas. They don't have to look far to a current set of political rhetoric that says to white working class people, the reason why you're struggling economically is not because of our country's economic policies that are being put in place by the very politicians you're voting for, but the reason why you're struggling economically is because those brown people. who are apparently taking your jobs because those Black people. So you have so many people who are struggling, who are then taught that the source of their pain are other people who don't look like them. And so I just think that it's critically important for people to realize that people weren't born racist. They were made racist. And they were made racist so they can spend their time going after other people, as opposed to the true source, you know, of the pain of many Americans, particularly many Americans of color. And I, so I talk about, many Black folks know this famous sort of speech when Malcolm X was talking to Black folks and saying, you've been had, you've been led astray, you've been hoodwinked. But I think it's important for white Americans to realize they've been had, they've been hoodwinked, they've been led astray, and they're certainly being led astray by their politicians today.
Ibram, did you think, you know, what role does history and our knowledge of our own history and the way we teach our history to ourselves play in this, right? That we all live here in the same country, but at times have vastly different understandings of how we've gotten to today, and different interpretations even of the things that have happened in our history. We're seeing this play out across the country, in part in response to the New York Times' 1619 Project and conversations about how do we teach issues of history. We've always had disputes over history. How does that factor in to our ability to have this conversation?
I mean, if you were taught as a child, and certainly even as an adult, that the founding fathers, to say nothing of the women at the time, inherited slavery, and then, you know, spent a few decades fighting against it, and then realized completely that it was wrong. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, then all rights were provided to Black people. And then there were a few wayward Southern whites who went astray and created Jim Crow, but that was righted in the 60s. And now there's equal opportunity and equal equality. And then you look out at Black people demonstrating on the streets against racism, you're gonna be like, why are they demonstrating on the streets? Everything is cool here. You know, we've progressed. There's equal opportunity. Yes, there was slavery, but that's over. Yes, there was Jim Crow, but that's over. We've righted our wrongs. So why are you demonstrating? Why are you angry? And if you've been taught that what's actually happened over the last 50 years is white people have been subjected to discrimination, reverse discrimination, and racism, then you're not only going to be confused, you're going to be angry, because you're going to think that you're the source of discrimination when, even though if you're white, you're typically, white people are on the higher end of almost every racial disparity. And so that's why history and your perception and recognition, you know, of history and how we got to this point is absolutely sort of critical. And so many people have been misled into believing that false history of steady and continuous and perfect and beautiful racial progress and everything sort of came together in the 60s or came together when one Black man stepped into one house.
Robert, you know, one thing that comes up in these conversations is people, critics would argue, right, that what was just laid out or this conversation means that America is hopelessly racist, right? That this is saying that we are bad people and have always been bad people and always will be bad people. How would you respond to that framing that we often hear in response to this type of conversation? You're saying America is hopelessly racist and all the white people are hopelessly racist. What do we do?
You know, well, I couldn't do the work I do if I thought it was hopeless. I don't think it will likely end in my lifetime. It's a highly adaptive system, but it is not hopeless. And I, there's a question that just never fails me, and that is, how does that function, right? Not necessarily is this true or false or right or wrong, but how does it function to say that it's hopeless? And if we talk about this, it's just making us feel hopeless. So let's not talk about this. I can't think of any other social problem that we would say the best approach to that social problem is never to speak of it. Right? A suicide, a sexual assault, eating disorders, depression. Let's not talk about those things. I think we know quite well that we do need to talk about them. If you can't see a problem, you can't address the problem. It can be discouraging, but we can also look around right now and see some pretty incredible symbolic changes, at least, that make a difference. So hopelessness does not serve us. And neither does guilt, by the way. And since you didn't bring it up, but you might. I want to be really clear that I am just not interested in guilt in any way. It's not constructive or useful. I think that some guilt for white people in coming to awareness of this reality is a natural response, but we absolutely must move through that, or it just functions to excuse our immobility, right? I did not choose to be filled with racist ideology, but I was. And so I don't feel guilty about it. I feel responsible for the outcome in my life. Right. So what is this looking like in my daily life? And what could I do to interrupt that or to change that?
Well, I think that gets to that question I want to ask. What is the role and responsibility of the average American, the average person, the person tuning in today? Right. If they say, look, I agree with basically everything you guys have said so far. Right. Yes, there was racism kind of baked into the society and structure. It's trickled down generation over generation. It propels these disparities in our society. And I would prefer that not to be the case. What is the responsibility then of the individual who subscribes to kind of this historical narrative that we've talked about how we got to where we are today?
So I would say ascribing to it without actively interrupting it is basically meaningless. It reminds me of people who read a book or take a class and then end by saying, I'm going to continue to think about this. And I always want to ask, and how will people of color know you continue to think about this? Like, if it doesn't manifest in some kind of action, it is functionally meaningless.
No, I agree. And I also think what every sort of person can do, if they recognize racial inequities and disparities in their community, in their institution, and they may even recognize the actual policies behind those inequities, chances are there's someone in their institution, there's some group in their community that's fighting against that racism. And so what can they do? They can join that organization. They can join with those people. They can donate to that organization. They could provide their expertise in some way to that organized body of people, because that's what we need. We need organized groups of people. We need organizations that are challenging racism, whether it's organized groups of researchers, whether it's organized group of activists. We need to be investigating racism. We need to be figuring out the policies that are behind it. We need to be proposing and pushing for policy changes. We need to be shifting the narrative that people are the problem as opposed to power. And we need to be utilizing our power to force or institute sort of policy sort of change. And there's a role for every single human, every single American in that struggle at the local level, if not the national and international level.
This is hope-filled work, as Robin DiAngelo said. People around the world have a deep desire to make things better. Our audience tonight proves that. We have guests from around the country, 44 states, and yes, also Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico and 5 Canadian provinces, Mexico, Dubai, Australia, Brazil, France, England, Germany, the Dominican Republic, Spain and Indonesia, Niger, Senegal and Taiwan. That's 15 countries across 6 continents. Mike, how exciting is that?
That is absolutely amazing, Chris. NCRC truly making a difference throughout the world, although a lot of those people are staying up probably a little past their bedtime. Ladies and gentlemen, while we have this brief pause between the conversation, I want to remind you once again, NCRC cannot do the amazing work they do without your support. Whether you're donating $100, $1,000, or $100,000, know that each and every dollar is appreciated. I do want to mention before we get back to the conversation, we have that $75,000 matching grant from Indigent Criminal Defense Fund. So if you are able to give at the $1,000 level with their match, it's actually a $2,000 gift to NCRC, and we so appreciate it. But once again, whether it's $25, $50, $100, or more, each and every dollar can make a difference. Thanks again for joining us tonight, and back to the conversation.
What are some of the ways that our nation's historical legacy and decisions as it relates to race and racism still manifest in the world in which we live?
I'm going to defer to Ibram based on that beautiful book of yours, Stamp from the Beginning. You probably have at your fingertips.
I mean, something as simple as, you know, when Black people were enslaved in this country for hundreds of years, it was a crime for us to run away. It was a crime for Black people to organize or join a slave revolt. It was a crime for a starving, enslaved Black person to take food from an overstocked pantry. And so what happened was, to be human and Black during enslavement, if we understand a basic desire to be human is the desire to be free, was criminalized. And so during the enslavement era, there was this obvious sort of connection between Blackness and criminality. And Black criminality almost became the same sort of term and the same word. And people at the time were fearful of Black people, because they knew these people were human and they were trying to resist and decided that they were not going to free them. But that fear of Black people persisted, and it persists to this day, in which you have black and white and Latinx, and you have police officers who fear Black bodies and who are actually fearing unarmed Black bodies more than they fear armed white people. And then they're using their power to claim, after they shoot and kill unarmed Black people, that they fear for their life. And in many cases, they're getting off in the way slaveholders consistently got off when they would terrorize and brutalize and kill Black bodies.
And how does that relate to you linked that to the policing system. How does our prison system and our conceptualization of the prison system factor into those legacies as well?
Well, I mean, it's in many ways, the police officer became the master, right? The jail cell became the plantation. And it was still believed during even the Civil War, you had many Northerners and Western whites who were fearful that Black people would go free, because they thought that free Black people would run ramshod all over the country and just, you know, riot and rape. And what's fascinating is, you talk to Americans now who are completely against any defunding of the police or even abolishing the police. Their fear, again, is these Black people will run ramshod, and Latinx people will run ramshod all over this country, and that all of those people who are incarcerated right now are incarcerated because they're dangerous, hardened criminals. And if we decarcerate, then we're going to flood the nation with all these hoodlums. These are fallacies. And these were the same fallacies that Americans had during the Civil War. And what actually happened after the Civil War, it wasn't Black people running ramshod and raping and rioting and killing, returning Confederate white soldiers who did that in the South.
And so what does this look like to combat as an individual today, right? Where does that obligation fall? I know, Ibram, you talked earlier about finding these finding these organizations, getting involved in them, and what are also the role of our institutions? What does a school do? What does a, you know, like, how do we interact with the world that we live in here if the goal is to dismantle racist systems?
You know, the thought that I had on that question was in terms of examples of structural racism is the school system. I don't know that you could have designed that more efficiently to reproduce inequality than the way that we fund schools, testing, tracking, that many of these mechanisms are not at all useful, but they do serve to elevate some children over others. And so one of the things each of us can do is really ask ourselves deeply, why do I believe my children should have the best of everything? And does that depend on somebody else's children not having the best of everything? So this idea that it's okay if schools are unequal as long as my child is in the best school, that white middle class and upper class parents are often the number one barrier to the kind of equality that could change schools, that could interrupt the school to prison pipeline, and so on. So what each of us can do is a kind of that relationship between a deep look at what we think we need and deserve and what we're willing to get involved in to open things up so that everybody has a quality education. So get involved in those local schools. If you don't think it is a good school, then get involved to change that rather than move away and, you know, get as far from that school as possible so that your child can have something better. That's the kind of investment we have to be willing to make.
Now, a lot of people right now are talking about issues of race, about race in America. A lot of people who are otherwise uncomfortable with these ideas. How or what advice would you give to someone who has been moved over the last few months by what they've seen on television, videos of police shootings, the protests, their neighbors outside? Maybe they've been listening to folks who say that they feel uncomfortable, they feel unsafe. And what would you say to someone who is not necessarily used to talking about these issues or these topics, but who wants to be involved in this conversation? How do they enter these conversations? How do they conduct themselves in that space? How do they avoid it all going left and sideways like maybe it did on Thanksgiving a few years ago? And what does it look like for folks who, unlike the three of us, don't spend all of their time talking and thinking about these issues?
Well, practice definitely makes a difference. That kind of breathe, slow down, have some humility, particularly if you are white. Just start from the premise that you are going to have blind spots. Be open to having other people help you see that. Don't think about making mistakes as the worst thing that could possibly happen. If you think that I am articulate on these issues, it's from years of thousands of mistakes. The key is that you learn and you grow from those mistakes. You don't use them as your excuse to refuse any further engagement. You know, when you are sincere and open, people can sense that in you and are willing to work with you.
What would you add to that, Ibram?
I mean, I would agree. I mean, it's amazing. You know, people say to me, "Oh, you're articulate," and I'm like, I don't think I'm that articulate. I feel like I have so much more to learn and so much room to grow. But I certainly have grown over the years, as Robin said, from constant sort of honing. And I think that the more we put ourselves in an uncomfortable place or space for anything, the more over time we'll get used to that discomfort, or even on some level, it may become a little more comfortable. But we have to start somewhere. We have to start in that discomfort. And that's not just for when it comes to talking about racism. That's, I would say, for almost anything. And so I think if we reflect back to any type of thing we were scared to talk about, or any type of injustice we were scared to join the fight about. You know, the more we did it, the more effective we were. the more we were able to sort of sit and control our discomfort. It's the same thing with being anti-racist.
Now, how do institutions, a college, for example, how do they balance or consider their varying needs, right? So when I think about college campus, I think about their, in some ways, competing values or priorities that, you know, first and foremost, the safety and education of all of their people. But second, the fact that they do want to theoretically create a space for debate and back and forth and bringing in things that are unpopular purely for exposure purposes or to be encountered. How do institutions think about that? What does that look like once we're no longer talking about the individual, but start aggregating up? Because so much of our conversation nationally is about who has a right to these tables, to these conversations, who should be in certain spaces, how we figure, you know, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, I would say that when you're talking about institutions, and you know, we should be thinking about what are the policies governing those institutions? Are they leading to inequity or equity? The policymakers, are they defending racist or anti-racist policies? Does the institution have a culture of racist ideas that say that the reason why Black and brown people are underrepresented here is because they don't want to come here, is because they're unqualified, is because they're lazy, is because there's something wrong with them? Or does the institution have a culture of anti-racist ideas, which is, how can we transform ourselves? What are we doing wrong? You know, as opposed to what are these people, you know, doing wrong? And I think that's absolutely critical. I know when it comes to the college campus and even the whole sort of wanting to nurture free speech, I have no problem nurturing free speech, but I don't think any college campus should be nurturing lies. And so we can speak from the standpoint of facts. We can argue over facts. We can argue over the reasons why the globe is warming, but we should not be arguing whether the globe is warming. You know, we can argue over why Black people are more likely to be killed by police, but we shouldn't be arguing if Black people are more likely to be killed by police. You know, and I think oftentimes you have people who are basically lying, who have not proven their theories, who are purporting misleading data. And then when we don't want to engage them, they're saying we're taking away their free speech. No, we're taking away your ability to lie.
Yeah, I mean, any class you take, you have to grapple with a framework. And, you know, whether you agree or disagree is not really that relevant. Do you understand these concepts? Can you demonstrate an understanding of these concepts? We're not debating the truth of the concepts. And I actually think that in 2020, if you are a professor and you cannot engage with some nuance and complexity in these issues, if you cannot facilitate these conversations in the classroom, you're actually not qualified to be teaching in the classroom in 2020. And I think if institutions actually looked at this, some kind of critical racial awareness and skill as a qualification, that would very much begin institutional change and policy change.
Well, and that speaks to another question that comes up very often, which is what is the individual's obligation to do this work, to do this research, to know what they're talking about as we enter in these conversations? Because very often there's a conversation about whether or not too much of that work is then getting offloaded, be it to the experts or the talking head in this space or your Black friend who you text about this, right? How does the average person equip themselves to be a participant in this part of our democracy?
Well, I think it's the job of the institution first and foremost, particularly if we do or if we are beginning a period of transition in which, and I would hope on the other side of that transition, that the individual doesn't need an incentive to engage in these issues, to have racial literacy. But I think what Robin was speaking to is that in a way, we have to create an incentive and even a qualification, as she stated, to be anti-racist, right? You know, and for every single person. So that the institution is not essentially putting, let's say, the diversity work, unpaid diversity work, on the shoulders of every person of color, and then having to constantly, you know, bring in outside folks who are essentially battling the current sort of people in power, as well as even the majority of workers. You know, I think that institutions should, if they truly do value workers who are committed to equity, who are committed to anti-racism, then they would provide an incentive. That's what they do for everything else that they value. So why wouldn't they do that for this?
Now, how do you all see our politics and our media interacting with these conversations? Not in terms of specific politicians or people, but rather in terms of how these conversations pop up when we discuss these issues, the cycle with which we discuss them. Minneapolis is on the news for a week or so until the next thing's on the news. And do you think there's any role in the institution of media in terms of the reasons that this work sometimes feels either stalled or that it falls out of the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it might be naive of me, but I really was taken aback by how powerful the media is in terms of where it directs our attention, right? And there was this period where it was just everywhere. I went into the grocery store and there were Black Lives Matter signs over the cheese case, right? It was just absolutely everywhere. And then it moves away. So what I would say is, and it speaks to a question you asked earlier, how people who are new to this conversation stay involved, that when those cameras go away, it gets hard again. This is a deeply protected system, and it doesn't give up easily, as we can see. And if you don't put support around you to keep your attention there, particularly if you are white, you are likely going to just get seduced back into the status quo. So the media is absolutely critical in this. And I wouldn't say that they're different from any other person or institution. Of course, people make up institutions. they have a responsibility to keep this front and center.
No, I agree. And I think especially the media. So, you know, journalists and even are essentially experts with words, or they're supposed to be experts with words, whether written or oral. And I'm saying this to say that, you know, it's critically important for journalists to use words like racist and anti-racist when they apply, and not be ashamed about it, not consider it to be a political statement when you say that someone who said Black people are lazy are being racist, just as when a journalist says, yes, when that politician, you know, punched somebody, he was angry. You're angry, you know, we all know what it means to be angry, just as, you know, a journalist should know what it means to be racist. And it's a descriptive term. It describes when a person is connoting racial hierarchy or supporting policies that are leading to inequity. And if journalists do not have the ability, do not have even the courage to use the words in the dictionary that allow us to talk about race and racism, then who's gonna do it?
Join an organization that is doing the work, Ibram Kendi said. You can do that tonight by joining NCRC in creating lasting change. With your gift, we move from ideas to action, and action begins to change the culture. Mike, how are we doing tonight?
Chris, we are doing amazingly well. It is absolutely unbelievable the support we are getting. We are getting donations from one extreme to the other, and we thank you for each and every dollar. I do want to remind you, I know a lot of you are engrossed in the conversation, and for good reason. It's an amazing conversation that needs to be heard. So if at this particular moment you're not ready to exit your screen and make a donation, please remember at the end of the broadcast, the donation buttons are going to be up there. Before you click in, please donate at a dollar amount that's comfortable for you. We've got dollar amounts from $100 to $10,000 showing. There's also a custom level. If you want to put in $25, $50, whatever the dollar amount that's comfortable for you, know that we appreciate it. And NCRC will continue to do the amazing work they do with your help. So let's get back to the conversation. We know that's why you're here.
You know, we're now coming up on 2 months, 3 months since George Floyd was killed. How do you all feel about the state of this conversation? Where it is now, if there has been movement, if there has been growth over these months, and where we are to go? You know, as we're staring down, like I said, a presidential election, but then a new year. And where are we today as we, you know, approach the second half of 2020 as it relates to our conversation about race, racism, and anti-racism?
Well, I see powerful forces seeking to discredit. There was that moment, right, when there was legitimacy and validity granted to Black Lives Matter, right? You saw it everywhere. And now I see the forces of resistance seeking to discredit Black Lives Matter and anti-racist, the anti-racist movement. And so we always have to think critically about what we're seeing and hearing, where is it coming from, what is the history of this person or this news outlet in terms of their efforts? Have they demonstrated a history of anti-racism and racial justice, or have they demonstrated a history of undermining anti-racism? That's what we have to be really, really tuned into, because it can be very confusing out there. And too many people can't think critically about what they're reading or seeing and don't ask themselves, so who is this person? And is this somebody I want to be accountable to? Or is this someone I want to be accountable to?
About 76% of Americans, according to one poll, if it's representative of Americans in June, were saying racism is a big problem. Now the question is, will a similar percentage of Americans be willing to support the big solutions to this big problem? Or are they just becoming aware? Or have they just stated the cause of this big problem is a president? And so all we need to do is get rid of a president, and then suddenly the nation will be whole again. And suddenly the nation will be anti-racist again. And then if people believe that, then we're certainly going to have a different type of problem in which racial inequity and disparity is persisting. And the very people who were aware of it now are essentially blocking its end. And so, you know, I don't think it's enough to just be aware. And I don't think, you know, Robin and I, we didn't write our books just so people could be aware. We wanted the awareness to lead to action, the awareness to lead to transformation, the awareness so people could have the courage to transform this country once and for all.
So speaking of books, I'm going to tack something on to what was my final question. I was going to ask, you know, for folks who are out watching, what do you think, or what for you is your call to action to them? What should someone who says, I believe everything you had to say, I'm down, I'm in, what do you want them to go do? And second, besides your own, what are some books you might recommend folks pick up? Because people in this moment, especially so many folks stuck inside because of COVID, are looking for materials. They want to understand more about the history or about the moment or about the movement. What books should they be engaging in?
Well, I'm easily going to say you need to read Stamped from the Beginning. if you want to know your history. But I love books that keep you engaged in a process also. So I love Leila Saad's book, Me and White Supremacy Workbook for White People. It's a book that you do rather than just read. It keeps you on a daily practice. And it's a practice that's both about your awareness, but also about actions that you can take. So anything that keeps you in a daily practice is going to be really fundamental, particularly for white people. And if you want to be challenged, if you want to really get a good sense of what white fragility looks like, just start talking to every white person you know about racism, bring it up, and pay attention. And you'll get better and better at seeing the ways that we make meaning and the outcomes of the ways that we make meaning. You'll recognize that idea that only individual bad people could ever be racist. I mean, that just has to shift. And the more you talk about it, engage with it, the more you can shift that. That's what I would offer.
Well, I think the only good thing about this moment is I could say, if you just go to the New York Times bestseller list, you're going to see many great books on racism, from Robin's White Fragility to Me and White Supremacy, to Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, to Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, to So You Want to Talk About Race, and so on and so forth. And you know, the call to action, I would say, is, as I mentioned earlier, like, join an organization, support an organization. Like, how can I support an organization? What do I have to give? Do I have time? Do I have money? Do I have expertise? What do I have to give? And I think we all need to think about, what is it that we have to give? What is our expertise? There's so many different layers and there's so many different needs within this sort of movement to transform this country. And we need every single person to be a part of it.
Well, with that, I want to thank you both for spending time today having this conversation. It's been enlightening. It's been fun. And I think it's important. Like you said, there are a lot of these conversations happening around the country, and it's great to be able to have a space where we can all sit here and talk through things. And so, Ibram and Robin, thank you guys again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What a great conversation we just had. And I want to kick it back to Chris in the studio.
What an amazing evening this has been. Thank you for your generosity in supporting NCRC's anti-racist work, Charting a Path Forward. You can continue giving in this event platform until midnight tonight, Pacific time. You can learn more and always make a gift on our website at ncrconline.com. Now, with a final remark, is Steve Dinkin, the National Conflict Resolution Center's president and CEO for the last 16 years.
Thank you, Chris, and thank all of you from around the country and throughout the world. We so appreciate your support. Tonight's conversation with Robin, Ibram, and Wes brings to light the work we've been doing at the National Conflict Resolution Center for nearly 40 years. We bring people together for dialogue to address some of the most serious issues of our time. We deliver training to help people navigate through cultural and racial differences, teaching them to stand up when they see something that is just not right. It's the essence of our mission, teaching people to seek common ground by breaking down barriers, overcoming injustice by strengthening relationships, and changing the narrative that has been in existence for hundreds of years. We invite you to join us again to continue what we started tonight. Listening is the first step. Now is the time to act. Join us in a path forward. There are a few ways you can do this. Sign up for our signature training, The Art of Inclusive Communication. Enroll in the Bystander Challenge, an anti-harassment training, or ask us about our training for your company or community organization, or participate in a community restorative dialogue circle. All of this information can be found on our website at ncrconline.com. As Tom Turner mentioned earlier this evening, the National Conflict Resolution Center honored the late Congressman John Lewis with the National Peacemaker Award in 2014. It was such a powerful evening, and we miss him dearly and only wish he could be with us here tonight. His loss is so profound. So in closing, we'd like to honor him with a passage he wrote that was published on the day of his funeral. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence, is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. For the National Conflict Resolution Center, I'm Steve Dinkin. Thank you, and good night.